Okay. So today we're talking about structure-based IR models, and I'll begin by motivating them with the idea of citation analysis, which is the traditional information science discipline. Again, I'm sure it was taught here for many years. It's been adapted to the web in ways that are both straightforward and sort of more metaphorical. The best example of that is the Google PageRank mechanism for essentially giving weighting the relevance of pages according to the link structure that comes in and out of them. We'll talk a few minutes about some of the problems that PageRank has and has been alleged to have. Hope you enjoy reading some of Alejandro Diaz's rant about that, because I think he does raise a couple of interesting points, and he also has a very good explanation of how it actually works. And finally, I'll close a little bit with the idea of web crawling to sort of, again, just to give a more context to some of these topics. So a structure-based model, and that's not it's not a standard category as, say, Boolean or vector or probabilistic, but it's a category I think that's important to call out because it is a distinctive kind of IR model. It says that we want to combine the representation of the terms that we're using in the models like the vector and the probabilistic models with information about the structures within and between documents. So that's both the hierarchical structure of a document as an instance, that is things that has a section and it has paragraphs and it has maybe captions and figures and call-outs and other kinds of structural elements within the document instance. And then there are links, structures between documents like hypertext links and other kinds of explicit relationships, some of which are in links and some of which are signaled in the text and we can use as structures that connect documents. And this tells us about relevance, not just between documents, but again, within documents. What are the most informative parts of documents? And we sort of know that intuitively that the title of a document or its abstract will be more about what the document is about than some random sentence in it. And we want to use that kind of information and intuition to give us more precise models of relevance and how to order the result set from a search. So there's a picture here that I cribbed from the Finding Out About book by Rick Ballew that I used the first year I taught this class. It basically tries to show, I mean, the title of this slide is Structure Beyond the Index, or the Index in Context. And the idea here is that we want to use, while the obviously the most obvious thing we've been doing when we index documents is to use the text of the document to extract the important words in it as a way to build the representation we're going to use to match queries. There are a number of other things we can do to enhance or go beyond the index or to find the content of the index. We can use, of course, things like latent semantic indexing or thesauri to essentially find more topical descriptors of the documents in the collection. But we can also find these things that go beyond it, that are outside the document, like the documents that it cites, the documents that cite it, where it was published, who wrote it, where that author is from, who their co-authors might have been, where they were educated, where they got their, you know, where they got their degrees, if they're professional scientific authors, and so on. This gives a lot of information about the value of the document and what it's going to be about that might not be as explicit or prominent in the document words itself. So if I were to say, would you prefer to get your news from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, or Fox News, or MSNBC, or Jon Stewart's Daily Show, I mean, you would learn a lot about your political biases and some of your other biases, and we could use that information to present you with information which is likely to be consistent with those biases, if that's what you wanted, or to explicitly give you things which didn't conform to those biases. There's actually a master's project which has started here this year by a couple of second-year students whose vision is to come up with a news service which explicitly gives you things that you don't agree with, where you have multiple sources of information which have been categorized to be biased with respect to each other.
This is Michael Manachari. You will maybe have him talk to us at some point. I should write a paper that'll be in next year's 202 syllabus, even better. If you heard that a conference paper was been submitted by one of my graduates who works at GSR, you'd have some idea that it was about something I cared about, for example. Okay? So that kind of thing. So if I say, which of these, are these documents equally reliable and authoritative? I mean, you'd have an opinion about this, and that opinion would tell me a lot about what kind of information you'd like it to view as relevant. I happen to like The Onion, but I think that in most cases I'd view The New York Times as more authoritative. So we can look at that kind of information beyond the words and sort of where the source is. Then we can go beyond that and look at the structure between documents in terms of link structures and anchors. And here's a picture that I drew about 15 years ago, and I was trying to make sense of the fad of hypertext, which was the big buzzword in the early 90s. And I was trying to see what kind of link things are there out there. So I've drawn this picture, which I still think is reasonably good about this. And it shows links between documents, like links 1, 4, 5, and 6, which differ in kind of their granularity. That is, what is being pointed from and what is being pointed to. Links 2, 3, and 7 are links within documents, and they differ also in important ways. And we can give each of these links a different type, even a different name. We can say that, you know, link 1 is a bibliographical link, or a simple cross-reference, kind of the back of the book reference. Link 2 is a cross-reference within a document. Link 3 is some kind of inline to a contained resource like a glossary or to something like in the back of the book information. Say, go look in the back of the book for this thing. I don't think link 4 has a name, but it's a link to a pointed part of a, as opposed to a point to a complete source, it points to some part of a source that's external. Link 5 is a footnote that cites another document. You see a lot of that in legal documentation. Link 6 is a footnote citation to another anchor or footnote with another document. You often see these really interesting footnotes in legal documents. They say, see footnote 12 in this other source, which is really kind of an interesting structure. Link 7 is kind of a hierarchical expansion or a call-out. Maybe it's something that's either embedded in an object of some kind, a digital object, or it could be something which simply refers you to look more deeply at some part of some structure in there. It might be something which describes, see this particular point in this table, see this particular value in a table, or something like that. Now, this is a kind of a topological view of, or sort of structural view of link structure. It's often more conventional to depict it in a network view, which simply shows the pattern of links between the documents at the level of the document, whether or not it's some internal structure within that document that's being linked to. This picture I'm not as happy with these days because I think it implies that all the things being linked to are of the same type, and that's no longer true. I mean, we have, if you think of the lecture we had on personal information management, we have a vast amount of things that we consider part of our information spaces. And this kind of implies that they're all the same topic. They're all web pages, they're all articles. I mean, I think that's wrong. So I need to redraw this picture to show different kinds of things being pointed to. But I think the point I want to make is that there's this notion of a network view that says, let's just treat at a coarser level what things are connected to which other things, which things are reachable, which things can connect to. And I think that if you take that one level further in abstraction, you end up with the matrix view of link structure, which is, again, it doesn't even assume anything about the nature of the thing. It hides completely the idea of what is it that's being linked from. It's just now just a numbered object. And this is a conventional depiction of a link structure that says which objects are linked to which other objects. Now, I want to ask a question. It's a really important question, which is, this is a full matrix. That is, it has entries above and below the diagonal line. We saw a bunch of matrices in the last couple of lectures which were diagonal matrices, which only were half matrices, which only had things on the diagonal or on the lower half of the matrix. Why is this a full matrix, not a half matrix? It's showing directionality because the link from A to B is not the same as the link from B to A. That's right. Where if we're doing cosines, cosine of A and B is the same as the cosine from B to A. So we essentially there's no assumption of symmetry. Yeah. Friday?
There was a Friday Dean's lecture.
I don't usually go to Friday lectures. I'm usually in Santa Elena.
They were talking about trying to create a system that would automate ranking of authoritativeness of sites based upon who is linking to it, what their various other criteria such as IP addresses. They weren't talking about the same kind of authoritative like you were with the New York Times versus the Onion. But my question from that is, are there ever sort of negative values for links in this?
In a matrix, these are typically showing connectivity or reachability, which is a computational property, not a values property. But Heather.
Sorry, can you just explain that again? The directionality.
Okay, so if I have a link here, this says that 4 links to 1, okay. Or this says that 1 links to 2 links to 3. This says that 1 links to 5. That's different than the 5 link to 1. Okay, so that if there was only the bottom half, we'd say, well, that's because A linking to B means the same as B linking to A, and it doesn't. So we have to have the complete matrix. Now, the question that Dan was raising was whether you'd ever have, like, anti-links. And we wouldn't in this representation, but we will have them later on, but we'll have weights that are sort of negative for, we want to say, this linking isn't helping you in terms of making you seem more authoritative or relevant. And that's part of what's embodied in the Google stuff, which I think is pretty insightful, because it reflects something which isn't really well captured in citation analysis in the traditional bibliographic sense, bibliometric sense. Yes, Jackson.
One quick. So, this meeting says 5 links to 1, but 1 is not.
One or the other. It almost doesn't matter, but is there clearly one of them, there's one link in one direction, but not in the other direction. I mean, I'm not sure what the conventions are. You can draw it either way. It doesn't really matter. It's just which one you choose to be, whatever it means. So why in the world do I have... Oh, okay. So this is a really interesting analysis. I mean, there's an awful lot of this actual analysis of link structure because it's really important. In the sense, you don't want to do an armchair analysis and say, I wonder how this collection is interrelated. You actually have to study it and look at the links and then develop some kind of structure that depicts that. How many of you have used the online or digital Oxford English Dictionary? Probably most of you have. This used to be these two gigantic books about this big. You find them in the library and you read them with a microscope because the text was so small to fit thousands and thousands of pages into two volumes. And in the early 1980s, Oxford University Press in Oxford gave a contract to the University of Waterloo in Western Ontario to develop technology and methods for taking that book and turning it into a digital book. They reckon this would be a major scientific research project because of the scale of this and the complexity of what each entry was. I mean, the entries in the Oxford English Dictionary ranged from 3 words to 24,000 words. Did you know that? The word set, S-E-T, has 24,000 words in it, I think, in its definition. And there was a whole bunch of words that have 3-word definitions, namely X, C, Y. Okay? Where it says, we're not going to define it, go someplace else to see it. But there's a huge difference in what the structure of each thing is. Some of them will be fairly short, some of them will be, you know, really big with huge amounts of etymology and quotations and so on. And that complexity of the item means that the document model for a dictionary entry is pretty complicated, and they're going to build this big HTML database and blah, blah, blah. Okay. So as part of that work, An awful lot of new technology in text indexing was invented, including the company that became OpenText. Some of you know that OpenText company. Tim Bray, some of you know, was a graduate student at Waterloo, and he got his start in text by working on the OED project. Most of the work was done by two guys named Frank Tompa and Daryl Raymond. So if you're interested in this project, if you look for those guys, you'll find lots of interesting technical reports. Tompa, T-O-M-P-A, and Raymond, R-A-M-O-N-D. There's also a wonderful book called The Professor and the Madman about the OED that, if you like the history of the OED, this is interesting. But this is basically a study they did to say, well, gee, I want to see how many references there typically are from a given word to words that start with the same letter. So this says that words that begin with A typically have 0.7 cross-references to other words that begin with A. And this is remarkably constant. I mean, it's a pretty interesting distribution. It tells us something about the language as well as the OED. But it's a very different pattern. This says, what is the number of cross-references from words in the OED to entries that start with different letters? So how many references are there from A words to other words? And the answer is almost none. How many words, references on average are there from B words, words that start with other things besides B, and so on? What does this tell us? It's an amazing pattern, right? So what does this tell us? Come on, one of you English majors even know this. Yes?
Maybe that when they're writing this, they're starting at the beginning of the working
period. Exactly right. You guys got it right. He wrote this from A to Z. So the first thing they wrote was all the A words. Then they wrote the B words, and the C words. And so it's kind of hard to link things which haven't been written yet. So there's been a little bit of fixing of that over time, but fundamentally the OED still shows today its history when it was written in the 19th century, the first edition. Because you can't cite things that haven't been defined yet. So this kind of analysis is really interesting, and the papers by Raymond and Top are full of really interesting stuff like this. My favorite one is this one, which is an exercise for probably the American political scientist to figure out. So some of you, I wouldn't expect you to know the answer to this question. Let's look at from 1600 to 1700 to 1800 and so on, the number of when we have quotations. The OED has lots of quotations in it, right? So what is the number of quotations in the OED to American sources? All right, so this is quotations from the United States, or what was going to become the United States. Looks something like this. Okay? Can you all see that? So the starts out that there's none in 1600. It gets up. Then there's a big drop in the late 1700s. Then it goes up again. So there's a gap where there are almost no quotations from American sources in the late 1700s. Why is that, Tony?
American Revolution.
And how would that explain this? So you're saying this is a socio-political phenomenon that the people in Oxford didn't want to have any of those radical colony quotes messing up our, you know, give me liberty, give me death kind of stuff. They didn't want that messing up the dictionary.
Yeah.
What do you think?
That's not bad, but there could also be a categorization. If you're having something that's an established colony with names dictated by a mother country, and then it says a turmoil, they don't know what it's going to be.
You could have a categorization problem. You don't know what to classify the source of this quote. Well, the real reason is that the boat sank. Turns out that these quotes are not done contemporaneously. They're done, you know, after the fact. And people are saying, well, I'm going to go do some research and collect a bunch of quotations and put them on little index cards and send them back to OED so they can put them in the dictionary. And there was a bunch of cards
later in the 19th century, that was this period, and then the boat sank in a storm, and they lost all, and they said, oh, that's too bad. No quotes from the 1780s. The point of this story is not that ships sink at sea, which they do once in a while, but that it's always an empirical question. You don't sit in your armchair and say, I wonder what the link structure of my collection is. You got to look at the damn links. And then figure out what it means. All right, so I knew Tony would get sucked into this because Tony sort of has that kind of inquiring mind kind of thing going on. But you were dead wrong, pal. Okay. Yeah, it was a good explanation. It's what everyone comes up with because they're thinking, oh, well, the politics, and we don't want those, you know, radical American colonies, revolutionaries polluting our dictionary. All right. Are you an English major? Of course. Okay. Why did you want to strike? Because you're getting your money's worth. Okay, good. All right. So we have these link matrices of different things, and we can use mathematical stuff to compute their properties that will be useful to us understanding the structure of the collection. The most important of them is, can you get there from here? Which is the non-technical version of something called reachability or transitive closure. Okay? So, some of you guys like Ayush and some of the computer scientists know all about this stuff, right? Transitive closure of a matrix. Who knows what a transitive closure of a matrix is? The failure of contemporary education. I'm sorry, I'll have to teach you what transitive closure of a matrix is. Alright, a transitive closure of a matrix is another matrix that you get by squaring the matrix. And you get it, and it helps you figure out if things are connected. So if you square itself enough times, you end up with this transitive closure of the degree of the matrix, and that says, can you get there from here in the entire matrix? And so, you can essentially let you calculate the distance between two nodes in the matrix. And of course, there are lots of interesting games about this. One of them is called the Kevin Bacon game, right? If we say, Kevin Bacon has been in a gazillion movies, okay? And he's been in movies with a lot of people who've been in movies with lots of people. And you say, how many movies apart is Kevin Bacon from somebody else in terms of, you know, how many degrees of separation are they? You know, how many times do you have to square the matrix to find the connection between these two people? So Kevin Bacon, who is somebody who is, we know he's been with like Meryl Streep, because that was in the movie called The River Wild. So that should be a degree of one, right? The one movie that they both were in. So the Oracle, the Kevin Bacon number is one for Meryl Streep. Okay? How about somebody else? Judy Dench? That's going to be at least a couple. Oh, I spelled it wrong. Actually, it's two. Someone named Deborah Grover was in a movie that both been in. Okay? Sean Connery. Two. Russell Crowe. Two. Anybody who's far away? Oh, how about Marilyn Monroe? That'd be some old guy, right, to get them connected. Oh my God, it's a two. So see, he's a pretty connected dude because he's been in so many movies that he's been close to a lot of people who've been in movies with other people. There's this whole idea about 6 degrees of separation that was actually a psychology experiment from like the 1960s that was done in a really ad hoc way with people sending mail messages from Kansas to Boston. It wasn't very systematic at all. They came up with the number of 6 degrees that anybody was like no more than six hops to anybody in the whole world. Turns out that somebody recently actually did a better test of that. Namely, Eric Horvitz, who a bunch of us heard yesterday at the Citrus lecture that I recommend you go to. Eric Horvitz published a paper in Nature about a year ago in which he took, think about this for a corpus, every message sent in instant messaging on the Microsoft platform for an entire month around the world and said, oh, it was a billion plus or minus a few hundred thousand, a billion messages, and said, who's sending messages to whom? Now, it's all anonymized, and sure, they didn't care who it was, but it was just individuals as points, right, in the matrix. And he found that the degrees of separation for the entire world based on 1 billion microsecond instant messages was 6.6, which is remarkably close to 6 that was pulled out of the hat by a couple of psychology professors in 1960. It's a cool paper. What?
I'm sorry.
Eric Horvitz wrote the paper. Yeah, you can find the paper. In fact, if I really cared a lot, now I'll post it. In case you can't find Eric Horvitz in the search engine, Eric Horvitz, Kevin Bacon, you'll probably find it someplace. Okay. All right. And there's a lot of cool stuff that you can find. If you like to see how this works, my favorite visualization here. It shows how you power the matrix up and you get the essential connections over time after the number of degrees is powered up. Kind of cool. If anyone wants to write the code for this, here's the code for it. It's real simple. Warshall's algorithm is the standard way to do this. The wall knew this. Why didn't you raise your hand when I said, who knows transitive closure? You forgot. You know Warshall's algorithm though, right? Okay. You could write this as a little tool for your classmates. Okay. To play with stuff. Okay? Be fun. All right. Well, this isn't just a game. Why do we care? We care because this notion of reachability analysis will help us understand the relationship between documents. Okay? So here's another example. This is the chapters of an encyclopedia that I was working on. And this is the matrix of degree one, order one, which is the link in the book, which chapter, which books. And your power is which ones can get to anything over time, and you find that a lot of these are very highly cross-referenced within the collection. Okay, that's a pretty dense corner of this topic space, and so on. Now, we've been talking about this purely structurally, and that's important, but it doesn't get at what Dan was hinting at, which is that we have to have an evaluative dimension to this. It's not just, can you reach this, but why are you reaching them? Are you reaching them to slap their face, or are you reaching them to say, I love you? Very different kind of connection, right? So, we want to have two distinct kinds of analyses. One is this relational analysis, which simply says, am I connected to you in this kind of link, in an untyped sense? We have a connection. I'm not going to describe it. It's just a connection of some kind. It's much more important, I think, to understand the structure of a collection, to understand why these documents are connected. And we could use that evaluative analysis to determine things like, well, is this a quality source? Is it important? Has it been influential on some body of knowledge or something? As opposed to just, is it connected to it? Now, this is more controversial for a reason that it's going to be obvious. Right? We're saying, why did you link to this thing? As opposed to, yeah, you linked to it. So we could count as a link. We say, well, should we count it differently based on the kind of link it has? Okay? And that is where we get into this whole field of bibliometrics or scientometrics, which is kind of a really strange term. But this is what has been called in the information science literature, like in this room. It's the structure of scientific citation. So we're asking ourselves, can we examine the structure of how scientific papers are interconnected to understand something about the invisible college of where it comes out of this tradition of scientists who are working in the same areas, as evidenced by the fact that they are intellectually influenced by each other, as evidenced by the fact that they cite each other in their papers. Okay? And so this kind of idea has been used to say, aha, there seems to be some new emerging disciplines like molecular biology is popping up in the intersection of chemistry and biology. Okay? You get the idea. Computer science is emerging in the intersection of mathematics and physics or engineering or something. Information, whatever we are here, is emerging in the intersection of cognitive science, business, and computer science, and library science. So we can find these kind of new disciplines emerging. We can find things like the H-index, or we can look at the Poor Man's Approximation, and then these Google Scholar to look at the number of citations.
that a particular document has, to get some estimate of the impact of a scientist's research. And people have used it to predict Nobel Prize winners, just saying, who out there who doesn't have a Nobel Prize has better scientific citation numbers than previous Nobel Prize winners? So they've been very influential. This hasn't been noticed yet by the committee. So there's like, you know, a way to predict that based on the structure of your scientific influence. Look, we could use it in more mundane ways than just predicting Nobel Prize winners. Can anyone think about them that we do in this building? We look at this stuff in this building all the time in a particular context. Can anyone guess what it is? In faculty meetings. Should we give this person tenure? They publish a lot, but no one ever cites their stuff. So they're basically just cranking that garbage that nobody cares about. A lot of publications, no influence, no tenure. Okay? Even could you hire this person? Are we hiring a person? Who is the thesis advisor? Has the thesis advisor had a good record? The committee is a bunch of people who are basically, you know, not really gone anywhere scientifically. Maybe this person's not very smart. They may look good on paper, but they're maybe not really good because they're people they work with that have never really made a big impact. That could be a kind of a bad mark for you. You came from a bad committee. So this kind of, how about the libraries? They have this discussion all the time. We have diminished budgets. Which journals should we buy? What are the most important journals? So all this stuff actually has a day-to-day relevance that you might not have realized. And that's why I had to read that paper with the incredible dude's name. I bet that Narayan can pronounce it, but I couldn't pronounce it. What's that guy's name? Kataranakatakul, the author of that paper on citations. You did read this paper, a little short one, right? You saw it in the reading list. You haven't read it yet, but you saw it in the reading list. Okay. All right. So let's look at a couple of the classic ideas here. If you were in library school, and you're not, good for you, you spend a whole semester studying this stuff. And you would read papers by Eugene Garfield and Derek J. DeSola Price, because they're the fathers of this field of bibliometrics. And there's a really interesting paper that I actually have read because it is just staggering in the numbers it has in it. And it's a paper that says, what's the most cited papers of all time in the scientific literature? Okay? And of course, not surprisingly, scientific citation follows a zip distribution. Meaning, some papers get cited a lot. Most papers don't get cited very much at all. Now, we'll talk about the reasons for that in a minute, but think about that. It means that some papers are very influential. The classic papers in the field that everyone cites, and some papers don't get ever cited at all. There's a paper that they mentioned in this paper, in the Garfield paper, was cited 187,000 times. Every paper published practically in this 30-year period cited this paper as the seminal paper of this field. Now, again, after a while, that's like you're just giving the rich more points. Okay, so the rich get richer because you said it because you want to make sure that people don't think you don't know about the paper, right? So if you were to write papers in this class about vocabulary design, controlled vocabulary, you would all probably write it and cite which paper? The vocabulary problem paper. You probably cite that paper by Furness Landau because you want to make sure people know you know it. So there's some biases in this, okay? But nonetheless, it is a major part of citation analysis just to count the number of citations. Now, anybody see any problem with just counting the number of times something occurs in a collection? Yes. Well, it could be the most popular. Yeah. Tony.
Well, I was also going to say that
Yeah. TFIDF, exactly right.
Yeah. So essentially, the terms that occur the most frequently.
Right. It may be one that gets cited a lot, but it may not be the most useful paper to you. Right? Do you want to add to that?
The quality of what the author is citing as well, too.
Yeah, you don't have a notion of quality. It's like quantity. Again, it's like, in terms of TF-IDF, is this a distinctive paper? Because it helps us understand some corner of the corpus. If it's everywhere, then it can't really distinguish bodies of literature for you anymore. And of course, there's biases about, if you only count the number of times some journal has been cited. Well, some journals are published every month, and some are published every quarter. Some are published twice a year. So there'll be fewer counts of the journals which are published less often, even if they're actually pretty important journals. So there's kind of a normalization issue here that you've got to be sensitive to. And that's why this paper was really interesting, the one I had you read, because it talked a bunch about that. But there's a wonderful sentence, and I love this sentence. The last sentence of the De Solo Prize article says, and now it's way more than 35,000, he says, a very large fraction of the 100,000 journals now current must be reckoned as merely a distant background noise and as far away from central as strategic in any of the knitted strips from which the cloth of science is woven. What he's saying is, there's a lot of garbage out there you can ignore. Okay? And of course, this is another classic rule of library science. It's called Bradford's Law. Bradford's Law is Zipf's Law for scientific journals, which says, some journals are important and people cite them, and some journals are never cited. So again, it follows the Zipf distribution. And that again, it's do you publish in journals that people care about, or are you publishing in easy-to-publish journals that have low publication standards? So again, getting tenure means you publish in the good journals that people think are good journals, which is one of the barriers toward, I know this is an issue that people like Heather care a lot about, One of the barriers toward like open access to scientific knowledge, we should publish in open source, open access journals, is that they have no history. So you're an assistant professor. Should you publish in a journal that no one knows about? Or should you publish in the most prestigious existing journal in the field that costs a ton of money to buy? It's hard to be the one who says, I'll publish in the new journal no one knows about, because then no one will cite you. They don't know you have to be there to be cited. You do care about this stuff, right, Heather? Okay. I don't want to mischaracterize your position in topic space. All right. Okay. So there's a number of attempts to identify like the impact factor. You know, how do you decide what's the most important journals? And again, this is very controversial, just as it's very difficult to find who are the most important people scientifically, because as you can think about, suppose you cite yourself all the time, which a lot of people do. Does that make you more important? It may make you egotistical, maybe. All right. There's some tricky issues. We'll get to them in a minute. But that's one of them. So again, there's this basic problem of the rich get richer, because once a journal or article or person gets thought of as important, then people cite them because of that, whether or not the particular instance that you're citing is the most important or influential or relevant work. Another way to look at that is look at the history of citation. Yes, Joan.
They're saying that they're most influential stuff. People don't want to publish in an easily defined journal because you can make money off it.
Ah, interesting. Okay, so what she just said was, in some fields like finance, the most influential stuff may not get published at all or not be published in very popular journals because people want to be able to sell that information and make, you know, consult on it and stuff. So they'll publish their things in obscure places that the insiders know about, but they don't want the masses to know about all their clever financial machinery they've invented. We know what that got us. Okay. All right. Way to go, Joan. You hang with the wrong crowd. Okay. All right. Make a note about that. Her reputation, she hangs with the wrong crowd. Okay. Work for the Federal Reserve. Come on. You probably even know people like Bernanke. Have you shaken his hand? Oh, okay. Maybe that's how you broke your hand. Okay. Okay, all right. So this is another paper, which is another picture, which is very interesting. It's basically showing something else. Now this is an upper triangular matrix rather than a full matrix. It says, let's show the relationship between citing papers and cited papers. So why does it look like this? Why is it not a full matrix? Time goes to the right. Yes, Thomas?
Because the cited paper needs to...
You can't cite things that haven't been written yet. That's exactly right. So this is which papers have cited what other papers, okay? So there are two things that are interesting here. One is the notion of a classic paper. So this paper here has been cited by everybody, okay? This paper here, at some moment in time, cites everything before. It's the review paper. Okay? Does that make sense? See how that works? So this simply shows, if you order these papers in by publication date, let's say, this shows which one, the dot means you got cited by somebody else. Now, what does this thing show? This is called the research front. Because that obviously most papers that are being cited are ones that are being cited that are pretty contemporary, they're pretty important in your current work. And so Price speculates, this is DeSola Price again, that citation analysis of this kind can tell us about the nature of scientific progress or innovation in a particular field or discipline. Okay? And he calls this the research front, and the width of that front reflects the hardness of the field. Okay? Fronts which are very small, very, very tight, are ones in which knowledge is being created very, very fast. A lot of innovation, maybe technological innovation. People see where I'm going here? Do they want to finish the story? Thomas, let Thomas try. Okay.
Well, fields that produce information that is going to be outdated very quickly because of developments in the science probably have a narrower research front, whereas, for say, in the humanities, it's perfectly okay to cite works that have been 40 years ago.
Right, right. So there's a great quote, again, by DeSola Price. He says, in scientific disciplines characterized by fact and finding, you can move through the packed-down past very quickly. While still a graduate student, let's say, and by the time you are getting your PhD, you can be doing cutting-edge research because you can sort of catch up with the field very quickly because the field is packing down knowledge very, very fast because of the rate of progress. Because the discipline grows from the skin and not from the body. In contrast, the humanities have a slow metabolism, where the field takes long time to digest ideas and lets them mature gently in the cellar of a scholar's wisdom. Come on, this is pretty good stuff for 202, right? Okay. So Price is saying that this is why, as Thomas said, we're still doing research on Shakespeare and Chaucer. Okay? Because, you know, we're not sort of advancing technology that changes how we think about Chaucer and Shakespeare every day and so on and so on. We have a slow metabolism for ideas in the humanities. So again, it's like, how long does a paper stay important in a field? It's obviously a lot less. If you're doing cutting edge in nanotechnology, then that paper will be out of date in a year or two. Whereas if you're writing about, you know, the humanities, it might take decades for a paper to be still in fashion. Okay. Now, all sorts of tricky corner cases here. I mean, how should you count papers that have multiple authors or institutions? Does every author get full credit? Or adjusted based on authorship order. People whose last names start with Y already get pissed off about that. Because they say, well, the authorship is alphabetical. Yeah, well, your name is Alexander. That's easy for you to say.
Okay, you get credit for the first author when in fact it was a joint work of five authors. Okay? Another one is the convention of, what's the relationship among the authors? So, if you know that someone is the lab director who has the big grant, they're going to appear on every single paper, even if they did nothing more than write the check for it because they got the grant. So, I recall reading not too long ago about a person who publishes 1,000 scientific papers in his 21st year as a scientist. And I'm saying, he's written a paper a week for 20 years? I can't read a paper a week. I'm not going to write them. But of course, he's a big grant getter. Okay? He's a guy who works in genetic engineering and he gets lots of money. He works with Genentech, those kind of companies. He's actually founded one of them. Genzyme or something like that. And so he has this gigantic lab and they crank out papers and he's on every single one of them. So of course he's written 1,000 papers in 20 years. Did he really write them? I don't think so. Okay? My first paper that I wrote that was any good, I wrote with my thesis advisor. The authors are Glushko and Cooper. And I used to say to her, this paper should be Glushko, 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 and Cooper, damn it. Because I did all the work. All you do was basically read it at the end. She goes, it's conventional for your advisor to be the second author. I said, I'm looking for another advisor. You stole my work, basically. I did all the work, and she took credit for it as a co-author. I was enough to make me want I'm going to be with her. Because I thought it was a bad sign that I was going to get credit for none of my work. Okay. My next advisor is famous for having... should have been the second author on 1,000 papers, and he's not a second author on any of them, because he just gave all of his ideas away. So it's the exact opposite kind of situation where most generous man I ever worked with in my life. A guy named David Rommelhart. Okay. So again, should you count self-citation? Yes.
So, my professor back in India.
Yes.
And he actually had to have his guide as the first author of every paper he wrote.
The first author?
Yeah. He did that for three papers.
This is time to find another advisor. I mean, that's ridiculous. Does his dissertation have his name on it or does it have his advisor name on it?
It had both in it. The supervisor was first. Even though it was all...
Different academic conventions, obviously. It's not like India's got more of a serfdom going on. The SERP system in India of academic citations. Like, see, that's why this evaluative stuff is tricky. Now, here's another one for you English majors coming up. This is a concept from rhetoric, sort of analysis of the rhetorical structure of text. You say, how can authors signal in their text the nature of their citation of some other text? So, some pedantic people call this the genre of invocation. Anyone ever heard that phrase? I love that. The genre of invocation, namely, how do you point to something else? Are you citing it? Are you mentioning it? Are you acknowledging it? You know, are you doing it in a positive way or a negative way and so on? So, think about the difference between if you said in a document, blah, 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 see this other paper, okay? Versus blah, 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 but see this other paper, blah, 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 see also this other paper. However, see other paper. I mean, all these very subtle signals are saying, I don't really believe this, but I better put this in because I want people think I'm being a good scholar, or, you know, I got there first, but they got credit for it first, but I'm going to sort of have to grudgingly acknowledge them. All kinds of code is in that rhetorical citation analysis. And of course, this is going to be important if you want to really figure out what the value of the thing on the other end of that link is. Which is why it's important to look not just at the link in web linking analysis, but to look at the anchor text on the other end. Because the thing that you're pointing to, okay, might actually show the reason for why you link to it. There's an entire industry that's built on this problem.
Anyone have heard of the word shepherdizing? Anybody here have a legal orientation? Okay, so shepherdizing, really interesting concept. Shepherd was a printed book series that used to take every legal ruling and would publish on some regular basis and say, since this case was published, what has happened to it? What courts, what judges have referred to this case? And how do they refer to this case? Okay? And here is the two dimensions that they can refer to it on. They can say, I can refer to it on the basis of its facts or on the basis of the ruling it had. Okay? So I can say, my case is just like Roe v. Wade or some other case, Baker v. Selden or whatever some famous case is, exactly parallel facts. Or there are different facts. I'm going to distinguish my case from this particular case so I can argue why it's not relevant to me, let's say. Okay? Like I can say, we follow this case following Roe v. Wade. We argued that. Versus, since Roe v. Wade was overruled, we can completely ignore it and go the other way. So, it's really important that you know this when you try to use a case. Because what could be worse than walking into a courtroom with the judge and saying, well, you know, Your Honor, based on Smith v. Jones, because the one that was overruled by the Supreme Court, you moron. You know, that's not a very good position to be in when you're putting up precedents which have now been invalidated by the Supreme Court or by some other court. And so, what would you pay for this? Would it be worth money to shepherdize the case? Yes, you would. You would go here and you put your credit card down on the Lexis website and you would shepherdize your case. Come on. Well, this is actually a credit card form that pops up when you go to Shepherd's. For some reason, it's not coming up, but there's a credit card form there. Trust me. Okay. So, everything we said so far suggests that we have these collections of documents which have links between them, relationship between them of some polarity. Maybe we can use that to look at the web structure, because the web can be seen as a network of interlinked articles. Right? So, let's try to do that. Now, why do we want to do this? We want to do this because if you only look at the content of web pages, it doesn't work all that well sometimes, because a lot of web articles are very short, and that would introduce some bias if you have short queries against short articles, because they'd have relatively high vectors, for example. Okay. You also have the problem of bad metadata. Unlike documents and control collections, the metadata is often very, very bad on web collections. So links as a way to assess or compute the relevance of a web page. So again, this is an intuitively good idea. We can say, gee, a site which is the authoritative or official or gateway or hub site for some enterprise organization, you know, berkeley.edu, generalelectric.com, should be some authoritative source of information about that organization or entity. And of course, it will attract links from other authoritative E&Os that have a relationship with them. So Stanford will cite Berkeley, Berkeley will cite Stanford, General Electric will cite, you know, other big industrial companies that they work with, and so on. So we should value incoming links from authoritative sites, okay? And if you're an authoritative site, then you have some reputational value to throw around. Maybe we should value things that you think are important. So a link from an important site should be viewed as a vote of confidence in some other site. Okay? On the other hand, if we say, what value should be placed on links from low importance or low relevant sites, someone who has a bad reputation, well, we don't want to have their reputation tar us, because they may be malicious. Maybe we just ignore what people who are low relevant say. But people who link to low relevant sites are showing bad judgment. We should punish them for being stupid or being a bad filter of quality. So you could argue that, yeah.
Well, not only does not release the problem of authoritativeness, but you also have the echo chamber. You could, this doesn't address the echo chamber effect. Homophony.
Yes, it does. So again, there's going to be some issues about whether this is entirely fair, but you consider intuitively and say, well, we should basically say people who are established authoritative because of their non-web presence should get some credit for their web presence because of their off-web authority. Things that they say should be viewed as authoritative. But people who have a bad off-web reputation should not be given a lot of credit if they go to the web. And if you cite one of those, that shows bad judgment. So I think we can come up with an intuitive algorithm for that. One last thing is, should we take into consideration the number of links that some site has, outgoing links? Should we let people have an arbitrary number of links, a very large number, for example? That's like, is that like ballot stuffing, where you get to vote more than once? So if you vote a million times, does that mean that each of your votes is important? Someone only votes once? I think not. We should probably have a ballot stuffing penalty of some kind. Okay? Because again, that's like the norm for scientific citation. Again, get kind of wrapped up in there. Is that self-citation or all of other things? Could you have like mutual citation going on link farms? So again, we have this. You can make the intuitive case for applying this kind of evaluative link structure to the web. And that's exactly what these two very clever Stanford graduate students did in 1998. Google is very secretive about how they do business because it's obviously competitively very important. But these guys wrote a paper when they were graduate students and they explained how it all worked then. So we always use this as a starting point. It's cute when they say we would never sell out. That would be dishonest and illegal. But that's a different thing. The basic ideas about exploiting link structure haven't changed that much. It's probably still the core of what they do. There's obviously a lot of cleverness around the edges, but this is still pretty important as a starting point. Why is it called PageRank? As a way of ranking pages. Anyone know? Because Sergey Brin couldn't figure out what to do with his name. That's why. Larry Page got to name it. That's why it's called PageRank. Larry Page figured out what to call it. That's why it's not called BrinRank. Brin isn't a homophone. Sorry, Page got away with a homophone. Okay? All right. So, the basic... Sorry, that's why it's called PageRank, because Larry Page named it. Okay. So, we could have it called the Beiler number. The Beiler number... How's that sound? The Beiler number tells us that... Get on, get going, man. What's up? All right. So the basic idea of PageRank is essentially saying that if a page has n pages pointing to it, we're going to calculate its page rank by sort of spreading around its votes. To kind of, how can I explain this? So you have a page rank which is basically based on getting some of the weights from the pages that point to you. And that's done recursively so that you start with some arbitrary starting weight and then you calculate this and you get your weight either increases or decreases based on who's pointing to you. And if people have higher rates weights point to you, then your weight goes up.
So what you're saying is all pages that have pages that have more increments?
Yeah.
So
the more links you have coming into you, the more you climb up. So it's obviously there's going to be a bias if you don't have any links to start with. Yeah. Well, I suspect that since most pages don't talk to most pages, it's pretty stable for any given page,
Right? So there's obviously, at the web as a whole is not stable, but any individual region doesn't have a lot of, you know, may have relatively little dynamic linking relative to the web as a whole. So you can, you're making an approximation then. Most pages are so small in weights that it doesn't matter that much. So again, the it's not like you're losing your own weight by linking to somebody else. It's not like you vote. If you vote and you lose a share of stock if you vote your share of stock in a shareholders meeting, but you don't get to have more votes. You have to dilute your voteds. You spread them around by the number of links you have. So that's why your vote for the link to site is divided by the number of outgoing links for the voting site. So this is why there's sort of this idea: is it better to be linked to by only a small number of sites, or a large number of sites, but the large, small number of sites would be the really important one? So you can try to see how people kind of manipulate page rank by making deals with other sites and that sort of thing. But again, this is not directly computing. I'm sorry, I skipped a page. Okay. Yeah, obviously there has to be some kind of normalization going on over the web so we have sort of the math work out right. And what they're going to end up doing is having most sites will have a very low page rank. So that's why people are so focused on getting into the top 10,000 or 100,000 sites, because most sites are basically have almost no rank at all. And there was a time when Google used to try to show that at the top of the web page, some number of stars or something, which was its page rank, but people just got flipped out of it because they were always low. And so they just gave up showing that. Now they just say, there you are. And I think that to a certain extent, it's become a kind of an arms race where people want to show up in the top 10 of a results page because, as you know, people don't often go to more than one page. But if you try things that are kind of trying to game the system, then Google will then find ways to punish you for that trick. So I think that most people are just better off saying, you know, have good content and do the best you can, and gaming the system really doesn't work so well. So there are these sort of search engine optimization companies out there saying, we'll promise you to raise up in hits, but I don't think it's worth the money because Google's smarter than they are. Google has more people working on it than they do. Okay. So, again, as I just said that there are these issues which are analogous, like self-citation and trying to find link farms where people exist only to create links to other sites. And that's trying to distort the true link structure in a sense. And so you've seen in the past, I think Google's gotten better at this. There was a time when there were political actions that were called at the time Google bombing or link bombing, where people would make a point to link particular pages to particular words in order to distort what you'd get when you search for those words. So there was actually a case where you would type miserable failure when you would get George Bush's homepage. Because thousands and thousands of people made that link to between miserable failure and that page. And, you know, it got out of hand. I think they fixed that most. I'm sure that Google has people who do nothing but sort of fix Google bombs. But, and that kind of gets this whole issue about the political dimension of search, which is why I had you read the paper by Alejandro. Again, I don't entirely agree with him, but I think it was worth having a discussion about because it does connect a lot of the dots of this course about trying to get you to be more skeptical about any categorization scheme, and of course, relevance is a categorization scheme. So you say, well, why is this document showing up as being relevant? Is it fair or is it biased? And Ian's already written a very nice post on his blog about this, and I think you've all got to read it. Mandatory reading his blog post. It was really a wonderful essay last night about, I don't know when it was, midnight or 8 o'clock, when it was pretty late at night, wasn't it, when you wrote it? What? 9 o'clock last night. He was energized by that reading. And I hope you will all follow his example. But basically, Google is saying that of course, this is very democratic because we're basically going to say,
things fall where they fall based on the link structure of the web, and a link from page A to page B is a vote, but not every page has the same weight because the most important pages, their votes count more, okay? Which, of course, means that if you've been around for a while, you have a chance to collect more votes from other people, so you're going to get more weight yourself. And new pages, because they're new, won't have many incoming links, which means that they'll be harder to be listed as relevant relative to an old page. Likewise, to the extent that Google says it's sensible that GeneralMotors.com should be a pretty authoritative site for General Motors queries. Berkeley.edu should be a pretty authoritative site for Berkeley queries. Then sites that have the URL contain, or the domain name containing the query terms, or the URL containing the query terms, are weighted more relevantly. They all seem to like Wikipedia. The reason I'm not quite sure about that. Wikipedia, I think, is overweighted by Google. Okay? Even though we all know that a lot of Wikipedia is kind of less than authoritative. Okay? So the argument is that conventional authority is favored and unconventional authority is not favored. And that is the question that I wanted Diaz to have you think about. We're going to have you spend some time on Monday in the section talking about this, because I think it's an important thing that it's worth having more than a 2-minute discussion about whether the way that this linking structure of the web works as a way to determine relevance, does it suppress new voices? How would you fix this problem? Would have been a great exam question. I'd rather have you talk about it in class. Everyone gets a chance to do it rather than just the 8 of you who answered the question. You question, what is a democracy? I mean, I think as Ian pointed out, we're not asking political questions when you say, what's the capital of Sacramento? Okay? And it's always possible, if you ask the right query, to find the unconventional views. But you have to go looking for them, in a sense, because the default will be the mainstream result. But maybe that's what it should be. So again, that debate's worth having, and I encourage you to get at it. And Ian will wear his body armor on Monday when he comes into class as the designated Google whipping boy for this topic. But this is for some of you who know the arguments about open source and code is code. You know Larry Lessig's arguments about how software, what?
Code is law.
Code is law, meaning code is code. Code is the legal code. Okay, the idea being that in some sense the software or hardware architecture may in fact embed certain values and make certain kinds of actions impossible. So that's essentially the Kentown argument we have here, that Google's way of doing search relevance ranking is suppressing unconventional knowledge. And that's the thesis for Monday to talk about. Okay? So I think we'll have in the red trunks, you know, Ian McDowell, and in the blue trunks, Heather Ford.
And we're in the same section.
That should be a good one to go to. All right. Okay. All right. Now, as if you think about it, this part of what's interesting about this whole problem is that it's obviously never right, because the web is this dynamic corpus that's growing, it's changing, it's not being managed. There's no one. I mean, you can imagine there was a time in 1996 when Bill Gates would have said, "You know, this web thing, you know. Let's set up a meeting with the president of the web and negotiate something, and we'll solve this problem." Right? Well, there isn't a president of the web, okay? So we can't do that. There's no one who's managing the web's evolution. And so we're never going to have an authoritative directory or catalog of all the things that are in the web. And so you've got to find out what the web is if you're going to do any kind of indexing on it. And that is not exactly a trivial problem for lots of reasons. And that's one reason why, even though all the search engines obviously have to have some similarity in how they go about finding the web pages to index, they differ in how well they do this, and then they differ in how well they weight things and so on. And so that's why different engines get different results, because they have to make all sorts of assumptions or choices about how they're going to go about figuring out what to index and how to index it. So in general, it's simplified. I can say, well, you start with a site you know, and you say, let me write down the links from that, the stuff I want, the indexes or the links from that site, and then follow links from there to someplace else, and then follow links from there to someplace else, and so on. And I do that until I run out of things to go to. But that's going to be pretty expensive and pretty slow. You may go to the same places many, many times if some of the places which are linked to by a lot of people are in that list, which of course some of them are linked by a lot of people. So we have to make choices about the order in which we crawl. And those of you who have taken computer science, like DeWall, know about different techniques of search. You'll have, you know, breadth first, depth first, where you say, let me go all to the bottom of this particular domain and then come back to the top versus follow all the top level links first. Again, it would give you a very different notion of what the web is. And you could argue that it would be better to look at the most authoritative page, which might be the ones at the top first. But again, who knows, right? So again, it's hard to make an easy decision there. One very important point is that, in fact, all those algorithms we just showed you were tree algorithms, but in fact, the web is not a tree. Because you're in these places where you jumped across trees to some other domain or some other place. And that'll, again, make it more complicated. You know, at what level do you jump out of the tree? And, of course, if the tree is changing faster than you come back to it, you're going to miss things and you won't be current. And different parts of the web are of different currency in terms of indexes. And, of course, some people say, don't crawl me. You can say, no robots, please, and don't come down this part of the tree. Or part of it may be hidden because of the deep web behind them, kind of, you know, application or transactional form. So what you're able to get to is very, very dependent on the particular approach you do. Again, some sites don't deserve to be linked, don't deserve to be indexed because they're bad sites. They're evil sites that exist only to create, you know, unwanted relevance, link farms, and so on. So again, it's a fascinating thing. I'm sure that there are classes you can take in computer science about how this is all done for the whole semester, but that's what you're going to get on structure-based IR. So let's go back and look at the most important slides. Again, this idea that we have another IR class of IR models where we're looking at information between documents or within documents rather than just the content of the documents is this class of IR model. This idea of a link matrix that shows what is connected to what lets us do things like transitive closure calculation to find whether you can get there from here, and that's very important to understand the structure of some domain of knowledge. We've used that extensively in bibliometric studies to see not just on a relational level is A connected to B, but also why is A connected to B, to try to infer notions of quality or importance or influence in some set of documents. That's reasonably well accepted, but there are some problems with it around the edges, like the way you manipulate it with things like self-citation or publishing in journals that are not entirely authoritative and so on. I think this is a fascinating picture. You could think about this for a year, about the structure of knowledge and different disciplines, and you can even see, how can we tell when we ought to maybe create a new department or something like that? Is this department really emerging? Is the window getting fatter or smaller? And all kinds of interesting stuff like that. And this is a very important point about understanding not just that is linked, but why. And you can do a very subtle analysis. I'm sure that Google and Microsoft and other search engines do a lot of analysis of exactly what words occur in link anchors. Because if they're words which have a lot of negative polarity, where you're saying, look at how these stupid people have said this, link to them. That's kind of an important indicator that you don't really respect the person you're linking to. Okay, so the text around the link will be very useful to understand the reason for it. Again, we can make the qualitative case is pretty easy to understand. That's way more important than the quantitative case. What kind of weighting would you make of different kinds of links? based on this intuitive notion of authoritativeness or importance. And as you'll talk about on Monday, this has some complications, because it may in fact have some consequences, unintended or intended, about which things get ranked highest. All right, so on Monday, we're going to talk about structure-based models, part two, which would be structures within a document as opposed to between documents. And there we're going to read two things. The Ron Bray paper goes very, very fast. He's a really kind of informal, colloquial-style writer. It's easy to read, easy examples. Of course, the Manning book will be very authoritative and difficult to read, and we'll have lots of interesting ideas about sort of computational implications of this. And I'd urge you to read the first one first, the Bray paper first, and then read as much of the Manning as feels like you understand what's going on in it. Okay? And with that, I hope you have a good weekend.